This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Here is CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. One question that's puzzled me. I saw a piece on Axios saying that consumers are flush with cash and are spending in a robust manner. That does not sound like a recession to me.
Well, it is one of those weird quirks of this particular recession, this K-shaped recovery, meaning that if you are looking at the letter K, you know that we all went down together. So that's, think of that as March and April. That's like, oof, it's terrible for everyone. But then we kind of inch back up and you start to see the people who were lucky enough to hold their jobs. Maybe they're working from home and maybe they're able to go into their office. They started to see their fortunes rise, like go up with that part of the K that goes up. And then there's another part of the country where you look down, you sort of drift down. So if you actually kept your job, maybe you're spending less money on going out to dinner, getting your hair cut, but goods have been rising. So here's the important part. When you look at the U.S. economy, about 70% of the economy is essentially the service sector. 30% is the goods sector. Well, look, if you look at the numbers, you could see that the goods portion, the spending on goods stuff, that's up since we started the year. The spending on services is down about the same amount, same percentage wise. The problem is because more of the economy is a service economy, we're not spending enough on goods to make up for that. Now, that could be changing, obviously, but given that we are looking at shutdowns and the surge in virus, I think the service part of the economy is going to continue to lag. And yes, if you're lucky enough to have a job, you may have saved some money. There may be some pent-up demand you might spend on stuff. But I have to be extremely clear on this. The amount of spending on stuff will not be enough to get us out of the hole.
Okay, so there is still a lot of misery out there, obviously.
Unfortunately.
Now, year is coming to an end, and you've advised getting busy on taxes now. And some of your considerations may be governed by which COVID programs you took advantage of?
That's exactly right. If you were lucky enough to get an economic stimulus check, so remember that $1,200 check, $500 per child, those checks are not taxable. However, if you received state unemployment benefits or you accessed one of the unemployment programs that was offered through the CARES Act, the money you receive in unemployment, it is taxable. And here's what's important. Many people didn't realize that, and they did not have taxes withheld for those payments. That could mean that millions of Americans could have a very nasty surprise come April and say, wait a minute, those unemployment checks, I don't have that money anymore. I can't pay the tax that's due. So let's not have that nasty surprise. Go to the IRS website, irs.gov. They've got a withholding estimator, and you can see if you've had enough money set aside to pay your bill in April. Now, the good news is that for many of these people, about more than half, they've gotten they're back on their feet. They have jobs. So it may be that you have enough money you could withhold from your current paycheck and be able to avoid any penalties in April.
Now, for people working at home, like, for example, you and me, can't we take a huge deduction on like our entire house now because it's our place of business?
Yes, you'd like to think that, but let's talk about the difference between you and me, Dave. You are an employee of a station, correct?
Yeah, right.
Well, as an employee, unfortunately, the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act eliminated all employee business expense deductions, including
what?
The home office deduction.
That's ridiculous. I thought my taxes had been cut.
Yes. Well, maybe they were, but this particular deduction, not available to you. However, if you are self-employed like a certain business analyst at CBS News, then the home office deduction is available to you, as are the deductions.
Well, isn't that convenient?
Employee. Hey, listen, I got to pay my own tax on the way up.
Right.
So anyway, anyone who's self-employed, someone like me, I can actually deduct employee business expenses, and I can actually deduct a portion of my home that I've been using for my job. Now, here is the very important part for anyone who's a self-employed or gig worker. The IRS has two requirements to make sure that your home or your apartment qualifies as a deduction. First of all, you can't have an office someplace else, even if you're not allowed to go there. But I mean, you cannot have an actual seat at somebody's business. That will actually blow this all up. Your home must be used exclusively and regularly for conducting business on a regular basis. And by the way, you can't deduct your whole house. I've got one room where I broadcast from. I've got lights, I've got mics, I've got everything here. I can't say, oh, my entire house is deductible. No, it's the portion that I am using regularly and exclusively, and it must be your principal place of business. Be careful with this. This is an audit flag, big time. So people who get a little piggish with their home office deductions, even if you are self-employed, you really want to keep it in check. Be conservative on this one.
Be honest, you chose the biggest room in your house, right?
Well, I chose the exact square footage that I'm using because I'm so scared of an audit, to be honest with you. I actually took the measurement of the room and deducted it.
Good for you. And you have not been audited yet, right? Oh, I know. You'll tell us when the audit's over.
Poop, you know, as there's a sort of an old Yiddish saying, which is poo, poo, poo. Like, you don't want to put, you know, spit away the bad spirits. I don't want to invite any audit, but I am a very conservative person when it comes to taxes because I always feel like, just in general, the idea of being audited is so awful compared to whatever benefit you think you're getting from writing off whatever's out there.
Yeah, right. And just briefly, any indication of an extended coronavirus relief package coming from this Congress?
Not right now. And that's a darn shame because, again, we've got 10.1 million fewer jobs right now than we had before the virus. And that's more than the 9 million jobs we lost in the whole Great Recession. And there are people who are suffering. So, again, there is no real movement this minute. Maybe when Congress comes back after the Thanksgiving holiday on November 30th. But it's just hard to imagine. I'm hearing a lot of political chatter that they want to wait to see what the outcome of the Georgia election is. In the meantime, people are going to suffer. These spikes in virus are going to cause additional closures, and the pressure on states is enormous right now. States are going to be without additional money from the federal government, states and municipalities are likely to be the next round of job losses that we see in this country.
Coming from her deductible home office, CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen and Chris. Last week, Dr. Robert Redfield, head of the Centers for Disease Control, said schools are one of the safest places for kids during the pandemic. Let's call in our own doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, do you agree with that?
I agree with that. If you look at the numbers actually will show you that kids really have very, very, very minor infections. It appears that there's not even 100 deaths in the country in school-age children. The ones that have succumbed to the disease have had serious comorbid problems, and in many cases may not have even been in school anyway. So I think the risk of having kids in school is really quite low. And as we've discussed before, there's a lot of other things, social development and their academics and so forth. And so I think everything we talk about in medicine is risk versus benefit.
There was something called the Great Barrington Declaration. This was put out by a libertarian economic group, but it was signed by epidemiologists. And these people feel that the risks of kids not going to school are worse, and this is what you were saying, are worse than the risks of sending them to school where they might possibly catch the virus. Now, when we first started talking about this, you said that the coronavirus was much more serious than the flu. There's now some thinking, and that's what I was reading in this declaration, that this is actually more on the level of an ordinary flu season. Now, is that true or not?
Well, we're still learning about the numbers. For example, on November the 21st, there was 177,552 new cases in the United States, and there was 1,448 deaths on that same day. Now, if you do the math, we're now at 0.8% mortality rate, whereas early on in this infection, we were saying it was 4% to even close to 5%. So how does it compare to the flu? I don't think we can exactly answer that question yet. But obviously, these scientists that wrote this declaration, they're all very smart people. One's from Harvard, he's an epidemiologist. Another one's from Stanford, another one's from Oxford. Unfortunately, it's unpopular, and there's been people based on their political persuasions or whatever who've tried to discredit them for what they've written. But what they're proposing makes a lot of sense, which is a very targeted approach to trying to deal with the infection.
Targeting meaning you give priority to elderly people and people who are otherwise compromised, but you try to keep life as normal as possible for everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the notion of sending kids to school, but, you know, protecting the elderly. Look, there is some decent logic to what they're saying.
I thought the reason that we were going back to sort of a semi-lockdown was because we're worried that the hospitals are going to fill up. And in some areas, they seem to have filled up, where now you can't get routine procedures because there are so many COVID cases. That strikes me as much different than the flu. I don't remember a flu season ever flooding the hospitals like this thing has.
That's actually not true, because I can say for a fact, as somebody who cares primarily for pediatric patients, mm-hmm. that I have throughout my career always had to worry about the pediatric intensive care unit being filled up with kids with respiratory viral infections, because they took up beds and then I didn't have ICU beds to put my open heart surgery patients into. So we've always had to worry about the flu season and how it affects the hospitals. And so now we're adding the COVID burden to the already existing flu burden to the hospitals. But this has always been an issue. It just hasn't received as much attention as this is getting.
I guess the reason people get excited about this is that we're talking about the kind of decision where if you make the wrong decision, the consequences can be permanent. I frankly can't blame people who are hunkered down and who are taking these precautions and who are scared to send their kids to school.
I mean, look, there's no question that as healthcare workers, we're seeing an increase in the number of COVID-19 diagnoses that we've discussed and hospitalizations. But what we are also seeing is that there isn't a congruent rise in the mortality rate. Mm-hmm. That's a change from what we saw before. And what we don't know is why this is the case. There's no really single or clear explanation, but people who are listening need to understand that we are heading in the right direction. And as we get exposed to any disease, whether it's cancer, heart disease, or in this case, whether it's COVID-19, we get better at treating it.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Here in Washington State, we have several virus developments. A big jump in testing demand has led to problems in tracking the coronavirus. Also, the governor has more than doubled a relief package for businesses that are having to close down or reduce their occupancy. And COVID, once again, is hitting the state's prisons and courts. Let's get the update from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
The latest count has Washington State reporting just over 141,000 total cases since the start of the pandemic, including nearly 1,750 cases reported Friday, the last day the state health department actually has data that it's reporting. That's because of several issues. On Saturday, the state health department said a large spike in testing demand for both COVID and other illnesses had overwhelmed their systems, despite their best efforts to be ready for it. Their disease reporting system can handle about 33,000 tests a day, but is getting anywhere between 30,000 and 50,000, which by Saturday had created a backlog of results for 53,000 tests from just the past 2 to 3 days before that. It also prompted them to ask labs to stop sending them negative results temporarily. Then yesterday, a notice on the State Department of Health's COVID dashboard said they wouldn't be reporting results for yesterday at all because of multiple errors in their reporting process they hope to update later today. All of that, they say, means that the daily reported cases from much of last week were likely undercounts, some of those days well above the 2,000 mark. In King County, Dr. Jeff Duchin updating the local situation Friday.
We reached a new peak with 581 new cases reported on average each day last week, which is 7.5 times higher than what we were seeing in late September, and about 200% higher than our previous peak in daily cases. Our 14-day incidence rate is approximately 300 per 100,000.
He warns.
This amount of cases has overloaded both the public health case and contact investigation team, our outbreak investigation team, and many of our colleagues in the community who are working on the front lines to manage COVID cases in various places around the county. Testing is up by 22% from a month ago and at an all-time high. Over 65,000 King County residents were tested the week of November 8th.
And?
Last estimate for our effective reproductive number was 1.4 from the 4th of November. And this reinforces the fact that our outbreak continues to grow. And as the size of the outbreak grows, the magnitude of that growth and the implications of that growth become ever greater. Hospitalizations have risen by 50% over the preceding week for each of the last 2 weeks. There were 140 hospitalizations identified in this week, and this is compared to the low 50s per week during most of November. There are now approximately 250 confirmed and suspected patients in King County hospitals, compared with approximately 100 for most of September and October. Our hospital systems are stretched, and they've activated their emergency response mechanisms to manage increasing surge of COVID-19 patients. I'm happy to report that we have still not seen a large bump in death counts. They remain stable, and the median age remains around 80 years of age. Important to note, though, there's typically a three-week lag between when we see an increase in cases and an increase in death.
And he reiterated,
encourage people not to gather, not to do these gatherings. The safest thing is to stay within your household members, the people you live with, just this season, just for these next few months.
In Pierce County, record numbers of cases reported over the weekend, but they also are dealing with a major influx in testing demand, leading to delays in their reporting. That county's two-week average in cases, 353 per 100,000 residents. Meantime, the state is also announcing a third inmate in Washington's prisons has died from COVID. The 62-year-old inmate was serving a life sentence at Walla Walla. He got sick Friday and had to be taken to the hospital, passed away the following day. Two other inmates from Coyote Ridge died over the summer.
And Hannah, what about the relief package that the governor's announced?
Big bonus. Originally, the Sunday that he had announced that there was going to be more restrictions, he said he thought he'd have $50 million for grants and loan programs. They managed to cobble together $135 million is what they announced on Friday. This is, I believe, coming from the CARES Act money that they still had. So it's $70 million in business support grants, $30 million for a loan recovery program that's also helpful for businesses. And then for individuals, for your workers, $20 million in rental assistance, $15 million to help low-income residents with their energy bills. It's more than double what he had originally announced. Certainly not enough, but there's still going to be some talks, and they're holding out hope for some sort of federal action, which for the most part, I don't think anyone suspects will happen until January, maybe even February.
Okay. And do businesses just get that automatically as an extension of what they were getting before? Is this something you have to apply for fresh?
You have to apply for it. So you want to go to the State Department of Commerce's site, and they'll have all of that. And I believe the app, you can start applying for those grants today. The businesses can.
Now, you mentioned that there's been an outbreak in the court system. Explain that to us.
So because of the spread, we're going back to what we saw at the beginning. The King County Superior Court has suspended all jury trials, any in-person jury trials. And the same is true in Snohomish County, where they've done it in the court system. They originally just did it in Superior Court there. Then they went ahead and added district court. Basically, no in-person trials going on right now. They're going to suspend them. That's a big problem in King County. Any criminal cases, I had talked to Dan Satterberg, the county prosecutor, several months ago. They already had backlogs of thousands of cases they needed to get done. Hmm. So the closing has been a problem. But it's just too dangerous, they think, to have in-person court go on right now.
So what does that mean? Does that mean defendants just automatically released?
No, I don't believe that that's the case. I think these are heavier, stronger charges cases that he said, some murder type cases and things. So they're being held and they just have to wait. Yeah.
Okay. On the errors in reporting, what was the nature of those errors?
They are not saying exactly what the errors were. It's just a very brief note on their website saying that they had multiple errors and they are not comfortable with reporting. I suspect it has to do with the data, the testing data that they're getting, like they had said the day prior, which is that there's this backlog, and there's too many different tests coming in, and it's messing with their ability to contact trace and figure out the trajectory. So what I do know is that they think that it's an undercount, most of what we saw last week, because of however these results are coming into them. So that's why they're pausing it, making sure that they're not going to take in any negative results for now, and not going to report any negative results. They're just trying to get back on track and deal with that 53,000 some odd case test result backlog, so they can at least be able to show what's positive and
but
get that positivity.
But the death rate remains the same. That's encouraging, right?
That is, but as you heard Dr. Duchin say there, is that there's that 2 to 3 week lag period. So I'm going to say when the cases started going up, we're maybe a week out of that. So I think the time to look would be a week from now, probably, is when they'd see if that's going to, if we're going to see that big uptick in deaths. But there's still the concern about the hospital capacity. Even if you don't get to the deaths, if they reach that hospital capacity or go over that and overwhelm that system, that's a separate issue than the death issue.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for the Daily Dose of Kindness, brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. A British boy who was bullied over his love of musical theater then found the support he needed from some big stars of the stage and launched an anti-bullying campaign to help other kids stand up for themselves. CBS's Ian Lee is in London with that story.
It's fair to say Charlie Christensen is obsessed with theater.
I love it all, the singing, the acting, the dancing.
But the 10-year-old's passion for song and dance made him a target for bullies at school.
They called me fat, they called me gay, they called me stupid, they called me an idiot, and they were all around really not nice to me, and sometimes it got quite physical.
So Charlie's teacher sent out a plea on social media. It quickly went viral with the hashtag #CheerUpCharlie, winning the hearts of the nation and London's West End theater community.
Cheer up, Charlie! Cheer up, Charlie!
Hundreds of performers from hit shows like Wicked and Hamilton sent messages of support.
Hi.
How are you? Come in.
Charlie also got to meet some of his heroes.
It might be tough now, but, you know, you'll get through it. And look how loved you are. This is going to be your home one day.
He even launched a YouTube channel to chat with actors, including Ian Armitage from the CBS sitcom Young Sheldon, who says he's been bullied too.
I think more because I've always loved sparkles and pink and things that are traditionally considered girl things.
Charlie is now determined to help other kids.
It will get better, and you will see a light at the end of the tunnel, and you need to talk. Don't suffer in silence, because we can't change the world in silence.
So he's teamed up with his new celebrity friends to spread his message of hope.
You will be found.
Ian Lee, CBS News, London.
I just love him.
Wow. He got to meet young Sheldon, too.
I know. Oh, I can't wait to get back to the theater and all the fun things gathering. Darn this pandemic.
And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here is G Scott. Tell us what he's going to do for Thanksgiving.
Man, I'll be doing nothing. I'll be
nothing.
Nothing at all. I'll just be sitting here chilling, thinking about Dave Ross. And some of the things that I'm going to be thinking about is I want to ask you, considering that the Thanksgiving holidays are coming up, what is your favorite meal on Thanksgiving, Dave?
Well, I mean, I do enjoy, well, I don't enjoy the white meat, but I love the dark meat because it's got more fat in it. It's got the crispiness to it.
Yeah.
I like the cranberries. I like this, there's a green.
Are you a canned cranberry sauce, though, or a homemade?
I have no idea where it comes from. I assume.
Wait a minute. Colleen, I'm glad you asked that. I'm glad you asked that because we got to get to the bottom of this. Canned cranberry sauce, period. I don't want any homemade. I want it right out of the can. As a matter of fact, when I cut into it, I still want to see the ribs on the side.
Yeah.
I know
you want
that
to
they
the shape of the can.
Yeah,
the ribs tell you the portion, right? But Dave, you were saying something about green beans. What were you saying?
There's a green bean nut thing with a crunchy top on it. It's a casserole of some kind, little cheese in there that the friends of ours make, which I've always loved.
Yeah.
Oh,
is turkey overrated or underrated?
Overrated.
Thank
overrated.
You, Colleen.
We're having prime rib. I
since we're not having to impress anybody with our perfectly golden turkey, I'm not doing turkey. I'm doing prime rib.
Okay, there it is. Colleen, that's the only reason that people make turkey.
I know.
So that they can, so they can show that your tradition. You put a
but nobody likes it.
Nobody likes it.
You put a bunch of gravy over it and stuffing to make it taste like something. You know, the only good thing about turkey on Thanksgiving is a cold turkey sandwich with salt and mayo the next day.
Colleen, did we grow up together? I mean, my goodness.
Yes, that must be it.
By the way, it's got to be on white bread.
Yes.
Oh, it's got to be on white bread.
Soft, chewy white bread.
Ooh, yes. But let me guess, Dave, you love your turkey with
like
a little mashed potatoes and gravy.
The drumstick. Yeah. I like the mashed potatoes because you can build stuff out of it. As a kid, I would make a little gravy reservoir, and then I would build a spillway, and then a little diversion canal, and of course a salmon ladder. So you could entertainment for the whole meal.
Hey guys, we're family, right? Like I come on you guys' show every single day, so I feel like I can ask this. What's up with green bean casserole? Why do you guys like that so much?
Mm, I don't. I've never had
it
on my table.
Green beans, huh?
I think we did grow up together, G.
what is the obsession with green bean casserole? What? Mm-mm. What is it, Dave?
Because it's delicious and it's got green. I've always liked green beans for some reason. Plus, I know I'm getting vegetables. There's a little bit of salt in there. You can sprinkle cheese on it. It's got the crunch. Fine. Don't eat the green bean casserole if you don't like it.
But I noticed that you
it
keep
makes
mentioning
the green beans all goopy and
you don't make them goopy though. The same thing with the turkey. The turkey is good if you keep it juicy. If you overcook it so it's dry, you could make a shoe out of it. But you're not going to eat it.
Sorry, Dave. We're not all as perfect as you.
No, I never cook. I always go to the homes of people who know how to cook. That's the other key.
Keep it a buck. A lot of people's turkey ain't juicy. And by the way, Dave, you keep mentioning vegetables. Like, is that your ultimate goal on Thanksgiving to consume as much vegetables as possible? Who cares about vegetables?
I get a farm box every week. I have to eat beets, chard, carrots, and sweet potatoes. So, yes.
You've heard about his famous bok choy peanut butter sandwich, right?
And the bok choy, yes. But you know, bok choy peanut butter sandwich is an underrated lunch.
He was trying to use up his bok choy. Yes.
Yes.
What else did you put on it? It was peanut butter, bok choy, and what else?
Probably some chard. We've always got chard in the house. There's always chard here.
Hey, the beets. Hey, I will tell you, the beets, man, I always forget that it scares me every single time when I eat beets.
Of course.
What is it? Oh, okay. Yeah, I had beets.
Yeah, you're fine.
Ooh, that was close. Ooh, I thought I was going to have to go to the doctor.
No.
What about dessert? Where do you land on dessert?
Sweet potato pie. Let me get
my
life.
See, okay. This is where we diverge because I've never had sweet potato pie.
Let me guess. You had pumpkin pie.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Grasshopper pie.
What?
Grasshopper pie. It's a green thing with creme de menthe and
I'm sorry.
Some
kind creme
of
de
ice
mouth?
Cream in it. Creme de menthe. On a graham cracker crust. Yeah.
Dave, you're that one friend. You're that one friend that everybody has. That's it. You're just that one friend. It's like, hey, Dave's coming over. All right, make sure we got to have. He doesn't like this. He doesn't like
you
that.
You have to drink out of the goblets, not the not the kitchen cups.
Yeah. No, we have tea. We drink tea at Thanksgiving.
Dave!
Tea and grasshopper pie. Green bean casserole, turkey drink.
You don't have an adult beverage, bro?
Chris, what about you? You've been very quiet today.
I fall in the Dave Ross category.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Green beans.
Green bean casserole. It's fresh beans, so they're nice and snappy.
And do you have grasshopper pie too?
We've had it occasionally. Turtle pie is another one, kind of a mix of chocolate and vanilla in a pie with a nice crust. Yeah.
Look this up.
It's a good thing we're isolating this year. That's all I can.
We would have the most eclectic Thanksgiving if we just had us four at the table. We would just be arguing over food the whole time.
That's right. Exactly.
Hey, Colleen, my family and your family got to get together, though. It sounds like we're on the same page.
Yeah, I'll introduce you to fattening potatoes.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
It is.
Scott joins Ursula 9 o'clock right here on Cairo Radio, where they fight over food every morning. And it's time to follow up on a story we were talking about on Friday, and that is, will Seattle be getting more police officers or not? Let's go live now to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Yeah, Dave. So they, as we told you last week, the Seattle City Council, when it voted on Friday through, or Thursday, I should say, in its various budget actions in the committee, it did not defined all the way to 50%, but it was a little under 20%, and it also did not support a hiring freeze, which was something that the various community groups and people who've been out protesting for many, many months have been asking for. And now this morning, there's a new last-minute proposal, an amendment from Teresa Mosqueda that would kind of make up a little bit for that. It would take another $2 million away from the Seattle Police Department budget and put it into the community-led public safety efforts. And in the end, because of the more than expected attrition that's happened this year anyway, they're going to be down police officers. But this makes sure that they, if it were to pass, that they couldn't use that money, I believe, to hire more of those officers. Not sure what community would think about this. I've got Amari Salisbury here, though, from Converge Media. Amari, what are you hearing?
Hey, good morning, Hannah. And good morning, Dave. Well, you know, what I'm hearing in my conversations over the weekend with a lot of people who are, you know, pro defund and everything else is this isn't what they wanted. A lot of people see it as, really the mayor kind of gets a deal as then the mayor gets kind of what she wants with police. I mean, we'll see what happens with Mosqueda's, amendment here. But then also the city council got what they wanted with the $100 million. You know, the mayor put out that $100 million. It was supposed to be a task force and everything else. And the city council and their budget basically took the $100 million and they're going to spend it the way they want to.
So when you say the city council spends it the way they want to, I thought there was a community commission of some kind that was going to do research into which programs worked and then recommend where that money should go.
Well, I mean, well, the thing is, Dave, is that before the $100 million was going to be, it was the mayor's task force, a task force that was handpicked by the mayor 100%. What the city council did is they took 70 of the $100 million, they took 70 of the $100 million and they kind of aligned where they would spend that 70, and then $30 million left for the mayor, but the mayor can't spend that $30 million unless her task force is aligned with participatory budgeting. So, I mean, believe me, the hundred million isn't how the mayor rolled it out, but the mayor didn't fight back against it. And I think the mayor didn't fight back on how the city council wants to spend the $100 million because for the most part, the mayor got what she wanted with the police.
Yeah, they definitely compromised, and it was much to the tone that I heard when I talked with the mayor several weeks ago, asking her what she thought the budget process would be like this time, and she said she'd had some talks with various members of the council, and they had come to some agreement. So, from my takeaway from watching some of the budget deliberations in the council chambers, I saw a little more criticism of, you know, no public fighting with the police chief, no criticism so much of the mayor. I saw Lisa Herbold and Lorena Gonzalez kind of come up a little bit more towards the middle. I don't know about you, Amari.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, and it's okay. I mean, because this is what politicians do, and politicians make deals and everything else. But, you know, I had a show last night, and I talked about where, you know, this isn't a debate over, you know, should a new road go here or community center this and there. This conversation that we've had for the last few months has been, you know, one of the biggest movements for social change here in the city of Seattle. And whether you agree or disagree with the protests or anything else, the fact that the city council is just, they've gone back and forth. It's been up and down and some of everything else. And, you know, I mean, what I said last night was that Juarez seems like the only city council member and probably Peterson that you can make a deal with and know that they're going to keep the deal, whether you agree or disagree, because they kept their position this whole time on the council. Other members have said all kinds of things. Oh, we're going to defund by 50, now maybe 20, now maybe this, now maybe next year, now maybe whatever else. But the thing is that they're impacting people. People are listening to them. And people are in the streets. People are protesting. People are everything else. The city council owes it to the city to always just keep it real, whether people want to hear what they have to say or not. But this up and down and back and forth is kind of wild.
Amari, I hear a lot of focus on the number. You know, it's got to be 50%. It's got to be $100 million. What actually changes on ground level as a result of this process? The ultimate goal is more wealth building, right? And a police force that's more sensitive to the community. Do you see any indications of change in that area, regardless of the numbers we're throwing around?
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm not, I'll be honest with you. I talk about those big three, Dave. I talk about income disparity. I talk about, you know, home ownership and wealth building. And I talk about the education gap in Seattle Public Schools. And I think that, yeah, a lot of what people are talking about here is the funding of social services or services around public safety. So, you know, I'm still waiting to see a massive investment, if it's going to come, in those things that are sustainable changes in the community. I know that some of this $100 million they're talking about, you know, ramping up those kind of things. But I'll be honest with you, Dave, what's going to keep black people in this city and keep this conversation going is addressing the income gap, addressing the generational wealth gap, and addressing the education gap. And so when you talk about this money here, and even whether they defund by 5% or 50%, if there's no direct correlation, at least for me, in my opinion, if there's no direct correlation to systemic changes here along those big three, then, you know, I mean, we'll be continue to have this conversation because black people won't be able to stay here. They'll continue to get pushed out the city.
Anna?
And so, and Amari, and I know after today's budget vote, as I'm sure you're aware, there's some teach-ins going on with some of the community groups who are going to be part of this participatory and solidarity budget process moving forward. And we're still waiting to see. I know Dave asks me all the time, what is the retooling of public safety looks like? What does community-led public safety look like? And part of the issue is we don't know that yet, right? These groups are working on that and will be for several months ahead, right?
Right. So my understanding is, and talking to them, is so that they're doing research, they're doing surveys, they're doing all kinds of different things. So we don't exactly know what that's going to look like here. I mean, we clearly want to know, but, you know, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like here in the future. And I mean, it's almost like it's kind of waiting to see. But at the same time, this is a process here where Seattle has never been through before. I would say this is that whatever the solution is for public safety, clearly it has to work for everybody. And it's going to take a lot of information to be able to do that, but they haven't really released exactly what that's going to look like yet.
All right. Amari Salisbury of Converge Media and Hannah Scott. Thanks, people.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.